was a very, very dicey job, and the Vietnamese, the PAVN, wanted to get on the bridge before the French pulled off because they were afraid they were going to blow it up when they left. And I assured them that this was not so. And Colonel Benny Potts, who was the senior officer in charge of that particular movement, and a chap by the name of Bob Barraby, a major, but eventually became a brigadier general, he was the man I considered him the hero of that particular thing, because he was able to convince both sides. And what we did in the end is they met in the middle of the bridge, the French pulling out and the Vietnamese, so they were both on the bridge, and then the French withdrew to the south side of the bridge and the Vietnamese came in. Another thing that's very interesting about that was the change that came over the town of Hanoi as a result of the occupation by the PAVN and the withdrawal of the French army. As street by street was taken over, immediately the PAVN arrived, you'd see the flags, the communist flags, popping out of the windows of all the houses and the cheering of the people and so forth. Orchestrated. Had to be orchestrated. It couldn't have been done any other way. We saw an immediate change. Hanoi was sort of the Paris of the Orient at one time. It was a very, very gay town. And I use gay not in pejorative sense at all. This is and nightclubs and bars, very beautiful little French bistros. Of course, they were all closed down immediately the communists arrived. I found the town much cleaner soon as the PAVN. They were great to clean up the town. There was a tremendous number of loudspeakers at all the corners giving lots of propaganda. There was lots of PT, physical training. You know, I'm an old jock, and I was delighted to see at 6 o'clock in the morning getting the local populace out doing physical jerks to the music and the instruction from the loudspeakers on the street. This didn't happen during the French regime at all, of course, but it was a complete... little things you'd notice, they're great on public health. And the people serving you in the hotels used to wear masks over their face, you know, little gauze masks, so they wouldn't breathe on the food and so forth. All a show. We were told by our doctors never to drink anything but bottled water. So we insisted that there was bottled water on our table. I got up one morning at 5 o'clock in the morning. I was looking outside my hotel window and found people bottling the water out of the tap. But this was to impress us. You see, it's a bit phony, but at the same time, a tremendous difference. Tremendous difference.
Well, there was a lot of distrust of the French, I assume.
Mm.
And were they not being as gracious as they possibly could?
I wouldn't say that. There were some people. Pierre Santigny, who was left behind to look after the French interests, in the political and civil side, and General Guy de Beaufort was left to look after the military side, were both fine gentlemen and both did their very best to make the agreements work, as far as I could see from my lower perch. Some of the soldiers who had lost a lot of their comrades and buddies in a very dirty, bloody war were not that happy about leaving. I found the same thing about the British pulling out of Cyprus. There's a antipathy against the enemy, and as far as the British soldiers seem to think in Cyprus, the enemy were the Greeks, of course, and they were difficult. We had difficulties there later on when I went to Cyprus. The same type of difficulty, really.
The work of the commission, though, was to avoid confrontation, direct confrontation within the commission itself, and to find a plan of action that all could agree on, and unless great principles were involved.
Right, right.
And to run as smoothly as possible. Right.
And I must say that I was so proud of the Canadian troops on the various reductions of these perimeters, as we call them, Hanoi and Hanoi and Haiphong, because Colonel Benny Potts, who was my operations officer on the ground, just did them marvelously. He was a tremendous soldier. And as I say, all the other Canadian soldiers rallied around. And, we, because we were on the senior people on the ops organization. We really did all the planning. It was done by staff tables that we had been taught how to do them at staff college, not for this particular purpose, but we applied the knowledge that we had learned at staff college to this new military problem. And it worked. It worked very well. Mm-hmm. No major incidents at all. There were some in the reduction of the Haiphong perimeter. Haiphong is one of the major ports in Southeast Asia, and very, very important to the economy of the country. And as a consequence, they were very, very specific as to what should be left behind in the way of derricks and cranes and port loading equipment. And I found our naval officer terribly important at this particular time, because he knew what a port needed to be in operating equipment, at least in operating, to operate efficiently. And the Indian and Polish naval officers apparently were very good too, from what I could see. There might have been some incidents there had it not been that we had technically trained naval officers who could do the job.
Their stuff.
Yeah. And the Haiphong perimeter reduction was also a very sentimental one, because this was France leaving for the last time, and General Kony was the commander-in-chief of the area. And I remember going down at the final day as they pulled down to the docks and loaded what equipment they were taking with them, and the troops getting on the boat and bringing down the PAVN, controlling the movement so that the French would not be, at least the French would be pulling out and the PAVN weren't putting too tight a perimeter on them. And Kony coming in his helicopter and getting into a car and having his outriders and all the things, la gloire of France, all disappearing. The last hurrah. Very, very sentimental time. It was rather like witnessing the death of an old friend. And I found it very moving.
Hmm. Were there many other observers, I guess would be the proper term, such as American, other nationalities?
Well,
look-see. And of course, I'm getting at the Americans.
Yeah, I've got pictures in my album. John Macklin was the Time reporter in Southeast Asia. Dennis Bloodsworth was the observer correspondent in Southeast Asia. Bill Stevenson was the correspondent for Canadian Press in the area, the man who wrote the book about the man called Trepidor. These are fellows that I know very well, because we had to look after the pressmen to make sure they didn't get into any trouble. So they, from our Western press, there are three I've mentioned, the Communist press had many more, and we had many more too. We had people from the Manchester Guardian, we had various observers.
What I was getting at was military observers, I guess.
Oh, well, yes, because what we had was our own people, of course. And there's no doubt about it that the communists and the from various other countries were watching this with great interest. In other words, the Czech military attaché and the Chinese military attaché and the USSR military attaché were all around from time to time. They didn't interfere with the work of the commission at all, but they were keeping a close eye to make sure, as military attachés are paid to do.
I was just thinking, if you came into contact with the Americans in the sense of they started to come in into the South, I know it comes a little later, but...
Well, I remember, and it's funny, I can't find the letter. Marg might have destroyed it. I remember writing home, and she remembers getting the letter. We haven't got all them in sequence yet. I'm writing home and saying, I'm a little worried about the Americans in southern Vietnam. They weren't up north with us at all.
No.
But when we used to go down to Saigon, because the commission used to meet once a month down in Saigon so that there would be a balance between the north and the south, and we'd have to go down to Saigon to a meeting. And I was a bit appalled at the, this was a military team to teach the Vietnamese, you know, and to how to use the American equipment and so forth. And they were allowed in under the Geneva Agreement. We used to get lots of complaints that there were too many Americans coming and so forth. But I wrote home to Margaret and said, gee, I hope the Americans aren't going to get into this thing like the French did, because if they do, they're going to be in just as much trouble. You can't beat these people at this game in this particular part of the world. It's easy to have 20-20 hindsight, but I think that's one time I made a pretty good prediction of what might happen. This was in mid-55, I guess.
Yeah, I find it interesting, the what possessed him to go in the sense that the French, if they could have held on in any way, I assume would have.
Well, you'd have to be a philosopher.
Yeah.
There are some people who say that if the time of Dien Bien Phu, the Americans had rallied round to help the French at that time, the thing might be different. I don't believe that so. I believe that people who wish to be liberated from a colonial power are going to be liberated. It might take years, it might take decades, but eventually, mm-hmm. if people don't want to live under colonial rule, they're going to get out from mm-hmm. under. And particularly when you had a military genius like Jack looking after the military side of it, and a charismatic leader like Ho Chi Minh, and Pham Van Dong, who was the vice premier then, who is now the premier, president, whatever they call him. He wasn't the charismatic leader, but he was a brainy man, a very brilliant man, too. I had a lot of time for him. They had good leaders, and the people were encouraged to throw over the yoke of imperialism. And they did. And whether it was the French brand or the American brand, they weren't about to have it.
How do you view your time there useful?
I found every job I had in the Army, from the time I was a trooper in the 17th Duke of York's until the time I was deputy chief, that was all useful. And what always amazes me is how the Canadian serviceman can turn his hand to the most strange jobs, things that he had absolutely no knowledge about before, was able to pick them up in a matter of days and start doing an effective job.
But I'm guessing they had as useful as, do you think the commission's job was useful?
I don't think so. I don't think history will ever put down the International Commission of Control as being a bright shining star in the history of peace or anything like that. We certainly saved a lot of bloodshed at the time, and I guess if you even saved one life, it was worthwhile.
Yeah, yeah.
But the point is that in the long view, I don't think it really was a useful device.
But on the other hand, I guess providing, or facilitating, I guess, is what you were, was facilitating the changeover and having an orderly changeover as opposed to bloodshed. And
mm-hmm. But the point is that in the end,
you had bloodshed anyway.
Yeah, exactly, of the worst kind.
What did you think during the 60s and 70s, of course, in the great bombing attacks of Hanoi in that area? You had been through the area, you'd lived there, you knew the people, you knew who the principal parties were. Did you have any comments for Chicago? I know it's recorded, but we're recording now, but do you have any comments on what the American and the news and the American military plans and bombing attacks and any views on any of that, sir?
My only view is that everybody, I guess, is entitled to one mistake during their lifetime. And I guess every country, by extension, is mm-hmm. allowed one mistake, and that was the United States' mistake.
The big one.
The big one.
What did you think of the bombings and things like that?
If you're going to win the war, I guess you have to do it. But I didn't think there was any chance of them winning it.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the, again, with your experience after being there, but what did you think of the peace movement in the United States, the withdrawal movement?
I guess I'm a rightist, and I believe in the old bumper stickers used to say at that time, America, love it or leave it. And I feel if it was the policy of the government to do that, then you can protest if you wish. But you've got to change it at the ballot box. You've got to find somebody who is going to decide in your favor. Mm-hmm. You don't do it by any other means that I know of in a democratic. Yeah, how lucky we are. Look at what's going on in the world today. Every time you have a revolution or a change of government, thousands of people slaughtered in Iran, now in Iraq. How lucky we are to live in a democracy where you throw out the government by being able to vote them out of office. And when Joe Clark took over, he didn't go out and shoot Pierre Elliott Trudeau and all the people who were against it. Mm-hmm. Boy, we're a lucky country. And democracy is the only way to live.
Well, I figure you're one of the few people, after, you know, your involvement there, you should have a say. How did you feel about the final settlement, if you will, the takeover of the South by the North, and the use of it for the American presidential election, a peace with honor and all this type of thing with Nixon? How did you feel about that? Just any feelings?
Yeah, peace with honor is a lot of crap. Okay. They lost the war.
Yeah. They lost the settlement too, is that correct?
I think so. People I feel sorry for are the Australians. They participated in the war, and they participated very well. And if you look at the geopolitics of the area, and just look how that Indo-Chinese Peninsula points right down towards Australia, I felt sorry for them.
Any other general views, anything that I've missed? I'm sure I've missed a lot, but...
Well, I think that the overall thing was that the people who were there learned a great deal. We saw a section of the world that few Canadians were in before or since. And we learned patience in dealing with our Indian and Polish colleagues. And we learned possibly that our values are pretty good values compared to the values shared by other people in the world. That sounds very chauvinistic, but it's true.
What about the Canada and its peacekeeping role? Do you see that as a logical development, if you will?
I think that Alan MacKinnon, about a month ago, the new Minister of National Defense, said something very significant. He said, when peacekeeping forces go on too long, as they have in Cyprus, instead of becoming part of the solution, they become part of the problem. And boy, I agree with that point of view. Very much so. Mm-hmm. If you can... Well, I have very deep philosophies on peacekeeping. I've been asked by Reg Roy to give a lecture on peacekeeping this fall to his students, and I'm looking forward to that because I really feel that there is a need for peacekeeping forces. I don't think we've gone about it in the right way, but it's not Canada's fault that we didn't. It's the planning at the United Nations for the peacekeeping, the fact that they cannot get every country in the United Nations to agree on anything, and therefore they haven't been able to set up the necessary military planning staffs to run the thing properly. Mm-hmm. They've got to limit the amount of time that people are there, and they always put a limit, say 6 months, they extend it to 12 months, they extend it to a year, 2 years, 3 years, and it goes on and on and on, and the people become used to having peacekeepers about.
So they're there to do their beck and call, obviously, in Cyprus. Now, you're finished in Vietnam in what, 55?
55, yes. I left Vietnam in 55.
Now, you left, what, as a half-colonel now?
No, I left I left as a colonel and became a half-colonel on the way home.
On the way.
And I told you to move something about the hotel in Calcutta. The garbage.
Took off your tabs, yeah. And mm-hmm. Were you some upset about that?
No, not really. Once again,
there were
people, yeah, that's happened to me before. Happened to be again. Exactly. This was the third time.
Nature of the beast.
Mm-hmm.
You come home,
and
you didn't come home first class jet like you did.
No,
airplane.
Yes, we flew home on a North Star, but they gave us a little time to recuperate. We were all in pretty bad shape by the time we left Vietnam. We'd been there too long, and they gave us a day in Malta and 3 days in Cyprus and a day in the Azores. We came home the long trundling route, and by the time we got back, I remember when we got to Gander, jumping off the aircraft and rushing down and kissing the ground of dear old Newfoundland and saying, boy, am I glad to be back. I remember that very well.
So Gander was looking pretty good.
Eh? Gander looked wonderful.
You know you're in trouble.
Yes, indeed. Oh, no, they had Screech. They had Screech in the airport.
Yeah, well, they had Screech, of course. Mm-hmm. You get back to Canada.
Well, the point is that during the last two or three months, everybody else was getting a posting, and I didn't know what mine was going to be, and I didn't know. I was promised 60 days leave when I got home, because the only leave I had all the time I was out there was 5 days in Hong Kong. And as a consequence, I was looking forward to seeing Marg and the kids, and we had promised to go down to the seashore, down to St. Andrews by the Sea, or to Bar Harbor or someplace like that. They were living in Kingston when I was away. And then, about 4 days before I was to leave, I got notice that I had been selected to be a student at the National Defense College. And I guess I was the first lieutenant colonel. Desdine Freeman, who was D-ranked too when he left Cambodia, he...
Nothing personal, eh?
No.
With Admiral Murdoch.
Admiral Murdoch was a student, fellow student of mine at the Staff College.
Oh, the Staff College.
Yes, this was the National Defense College, which I went to, that we started on the 9th of September, 1955, and went through to July, 1956.
And that would be RCAF, RCN, and...
Oh, External Affairs.
External Affairs.
Yes.
That's Flores training there, President Minister, isn't it?
Yes, indeed. I'm sure that if you talk to Miss McDonald, too, you'd find that it stood her in good stead in her new portfolio. She knows a great deal more about the world as a result of her year at the National Defense College than most people in that particular job. After all, we've had ministers of national, at least ministers, Secretary of State for External Affairs, who boasted openly that the reason they'd make good external affairs ministers is they'd never been out of the country.
Yes.
the man will be nameless, but it's a color.
Uh-huh. In this particular, well, we won't go into his name.
Now, the thing is that that the National Defense College is an extremely good school. We had people from the CNR, we had people from CPR, from Bell Telephone Company, we had... various industrialists. We had some very good students from the State Department in the United States, from the British Foreign Office, and people who have remained very good friends of mine over the years, too.
Did you have any more midterm graduates there?
No.
It was just Green there?
Yeah. What? Yes, there's no formal examinations. You've got to work, and they burn your tail if you don't, but the point is that...
What was the type of thing... that you would do?
Well, we had lecturers from the universities on Canadian economic policy and things of that nature. We traveled a great deal. United Nations, we studied the United Nations inside out. We studied NATO inside out. We studied CENTCO inside out. We studied domestic problems. The country I zeroed in on, we were given a special country. Mine was Yugoslavia. On the domestic scene was pipelines, transmission systems. They were the two things that I majored in, if you can call it that.
See.
Found it very interesting.
Now, you also kept up some work in geography, is that correct?
Yes, I went back, I think I told you, to do some postgraduate work in geography at McGill during the summer of 47 and 48. I was away for 6-7 weeks both summers from my job as Commandant Fort Churchill, and then when I got back to Ottawa, I went to study geography again at the University of Ottawa. I was Zaborsky was the head of the chair of geography at the University of Ottawa. He was a very famous, internationally known geographer, and I studied at his feet for a while.
This good job's good study again for.
I think that the study of geography is a great help to a soldier. I really do. And I mean geography in its widest sense as the synthesis of the natural sciences.
Social sciences and natural sciences. Combination. Thank you, Major General Tedley. Next day we'll pick up when you go to Prairie Command and later on into Cyprus and promoted to Brigadier, later Major General, and those types of things at a later date.
Great.
That's agreeable.
That's
Thank you very much, sir.